What is going on, guys? Welcome back to another episode of Closing the Deal. I am one of your hosts, Zach Dixon, and sitting across from my screen today is my co-host, Sam Enright. What's going on today, Sam?
What's going on? How are you?
Oh, can't complain, can't complain. Summer dog day or dog days of summer are carrying on, aren't they?
They certainly are. We have made our way into July, so we are officially 6 months into 2025, which is pretty remarkable to say, honestly.
I saw multiple people posting about that today, actually, just how it by a snap of the finger, it's July 1st. You know, we it felt like yesterday was January 1st, just watching the Buckeyes stomp Oregon in the Rose Bowl. And yeah, now we're here 6 months later, which is honestly, I think, how time is going to go for the rest of life. But that's just something we'll have to get used to.
Yeah, I do wonder if time will slow down as you get older. Like older, obviously, as we make our way into our 30s, 40s, 50s, I do not see time slowing down. But I do wonder, you know, once you reach retirement age and, you know, maybe your days become less filled with constant tasks and just different things going on, if life slows down a little bit for you. You know, it's actually crazy. I feel like when I was a kid, I used to go on vacation and I feel like the time would fly by on vacation. Like it would just be here and gone and you'd be like, oh my gosh, now I have to go back home. And now it's like when I go on vacation, I feel like the vacation is longer than my normal work week because like when I'm here, like there's just always something constantly going on. And it's like when you go on vacation, you get to sit by the pool. Like there's just, it's a way to slow down time, I think, you know, just with less tasks. And I think that's ultimately why we think time flies, right? Because, I mean, time goes the same as it did when we were 10 years old as it is now. It's just the perception of how fast it goes has changed. And I think the biggest thing is when you get caught up in tasks or things you're doing, like your brain's not thinking about time. Like I remember being younger and just be like, you used to look up the clock at school, right? And just be like, oh my goodness, is this ever going to come to an end? Like now we're in intervention. It's like, dude, lunch is still 2 hours from now. Like, can we figure out how to get this here faster? And it's like, now I like look up and I'm like, holy crap, it's already 5 o'clock. Like it's time to go home. Like my list of stuff to do is still long. It's just crazy.
That is, it really is crazy when you sit down and think about it. Honestly, there's just there's no explanation to it. How, because again, you're spot on with the school feeling, with the workday feeling, with the vacation feeling. I remember all of those things are things I experience as well. Really is just, it's crazy. Just trying to adapt to it. Like I mentioned though, you know, just try to stop and smell the roses sometimes, have those slow moments past when we're on vacation and you know, just enjoy life because it does pass us by pretty quickly.
Certainly does, man. It certainly does. I know all those things are cliches to say, but I guess, you know, they're cliches for a reason, you know, and it's always funny. Parents try to warn you of these things when you're a kid and you're like, dude, you have no clue what you're talking about. Like you're so far removed from high school. How could you possibly know what life's going to be like afterwards or any of that? You know what I mean? So it's always funny when you get a little bit older and you just think back to like, wow, yeah, they had it right. Just too blind to see at the time, you know?
That's a tale as old as time. I think that's going to continue through the generations though. Continue and continue and continue for sure.
Oh, you don't even have to be that far removed. Like I talked to my sister we're 8 years difference, my youngest sister, and you know, she's going into high school. I graduate. I mean, we're talking like, you know, she's in high school and I guess when she was a freshman, I would have been, you know, 24, I guess, would have been kind of on the same time frame. So it's like, you know, I've only been out of high school for, you know, 6 years, like, and it's like I'm archaic. Like I have no clue what's like what could possibly be going on in a high school when I was literally in there 6 years ago. And you know, usually most habits die hard after high school. It's not like you just get out and things just automatically change. Usually you stay kind of the same for those first couple of years afterwards as well. So
6 years to a kid is truly an eternity, like forever, 100 years, a lifetime, all of the above. But once you get older, you know, 6 years is not that much. Like I still think today, like, wow, 2019 feels like yesterday. That was 6 years ago. It's just crazy. All in all, crazy.
Yep. I could not agree more, man. I could sit and think and talk about time and all of that for a very long, very, very long time.
And I think Yeah, honestly, I think that parlays us into our new series, though. Honestly, a what if series, just thinking about backwards and time, all in all, what could be. So why don't you tell us a little about our new series here?
Yeah, so I mean, this was kind of an idea, I guess, that came to us. And it was just like, you know, we talk about all these things, right? We give everything in an informational way. You know, a lot of these topics, I feel like maybe we've touched on a little bit, but I guess my thought was maybe try to create more real life scenarios of what you could actually encounter and, you know, give you an answer or give you an idea of what that actually looks like, you know, if that does come to pass, which is a little bit more different than just your book to book definitions of like, this is, you know, what happens in a mortgage transaction. This is what to expect, you know, and it's like, it's so hard because there's always so many variables that could come into play. So it's like you have endless what ifs, because no one deal is the same. You know what I mean? You have different clients, you have different incomes, you have different credit scores, you have different homes. And so the possibilities of what you could come across are ever changing for clients. So I thought it would be kind of cool to just give a little bit of an idea of, you know, what if this happens and give you guys an idea, give you an answer of what that actually would look like for you, what to expect, you know, in those different scenarios.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, I think this is a series that we can do for a very, very, very long time. There's going to be a lot of different what ifs that can, you know, a lot of different things that can pop up throughout a contract or, you know, home search or et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of different ideas we can go and a lot of different ways we can go with it too.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, we experience it every day. I mean, you know, I could come up with three what ifs based on just current, you know, deals that we have going on. Like, what if this happens? You know what I'm saying? Because like I said, just everything is different. You know, of all the deals we have in the pipeline, no one, again, is the same. You know, everything is just, there's just a little bit of difference to it. Even if you're working with the same loan program, not everybody has the same, you know, sort of bones to the structure of their loan. And so it's ever ending. You know what I mean? So we could talk about it forever.
Couldn't agree more. Well, let's get started with our first one. It's going to be, what if the appraisal comes in too low against the purchase price? What happens now?
Yeah. So, kind of a couple of different things, you know, could happen, I guess. And so, you know, this is kind of a question we do get, you know, oftentimes from first time home buyers, because they are curious, you know, what does happen. So, you know, first and foremost, from a lender side, because we are the first person to receive the appraisal once it comes in, we're going to be the main point of contact. We order it, we get it from the appraiser. And so we're going to be the first ones to touch eyes on it. We're going to see, hey, you know, the value came in low. What do we do from here? So, you know, I always start with, you know, kind of the structure of the loan. You know, what sort of situation do we have here? You know, are we working with a borrower who's minimum down payment? Are we working with a borrower who is putting a lot more down? They have extra reserves in the bank, those sort of things. And then always talk with the agent first and foremost. Just give them a call. Buyer's agent, that is. Always going to call them and let them know, like, hey, here's the situation. Our client's appraisal has come in. You know, the value's $5,000 less than expected. And kind of let the agent, you know, sort of take over from there. I'm going to let them communicate with the listing agent, get in touch with the buyer, let them know kind of what's going on. And then, you know, let them go sharpen their pencil and kind of figure out, hey, what are the steps from here? You know, and we'll get back involved, obviously, if the borrower, you know, we had a situation where I think last year we had a client that the appraisal came in $5,000 less, and they went back and negotiated with the seller. And the seller said, we'll cover $2,500 if you cover $2,500. And so basically they lowered the purchase price by $2,500, and the buyer agreed that they would then bring it. Basically, it's how it works out on our end, but you know, they were bringing an additional $2,500 to closing to cover that that amount. And so usually that's how it works. If the appraisal comes in too low, gonna kind of push it back into the boat of the buyer's agent and let them kind of figure out how we're going to structure it from there. Are we going to ask the seller to come down? Is the buyer going to cover that themselves? Are we going to say, hey, this appraiser's crazy, like, let's get some comps together, let's send it back off to the appraiser, try to get the value up to where we believe it's going to be? You know, it all just depends on, you know, kind of what the belief around the property is. You know, do we think that the value is there, or do we think that the value where it came in at is justified, or did somebody have a hunch on that? You know what I mean? Before, you know, they even went into contract, like, this might be priced a little too high, we're going a little aggressive. there's a chance that this could come in under. So that's kind of the lender perspective of what's going to happen if it comes in too low. So Zach, kind of give them, because I know it said pass off to the buyer's agent, you know, in your experience, you know, when the lender does contact you and say, hey, you know, the appraisal's in low, you know, what are the first steps on your side of things and where you're going to take things at?
Yeah. So like you mentioned, we're going to get in touch with the seller's agent and just be obviously upfront and transparent about the whole, about the process as a whole. Obviously they're going to find out this information one way or another. So, got to make sure that we're communicating that upfront and making sure that, you know, we all want to be on the same page of getting this deal closed. Ultimately, you know, the seller put the property on the market for a reason. You know, the buyer put an offer in on this specific property for a reason. So ultimately, it's about trying to get on the same page and get the deal closed for all the parties involved. And so at that point, it's really just, you know, going back and forth, but also taking a step back and trying to figure out where is the, you know, middle ground win-win scenario here. How do we make this work for all parties and ultimately get past this hurdle that we have, and then get to the closing table? And so, like you mentioned, you know, obviously it is negotiable. So there's scenarios where, you know, the seller will take care of it all. There's scenarios where the buyer will take care of it all. And then there's scenarios where, you know, it'll be split between the two, in that scenario. But it really is about just kind of coming together and having that conversation together and making sure that you guys are all on the same page, because ultimately if it does fall out of contract, depending on the loan program and different factors, it could be a difficult process getting it back into contract after that fact. And so ultimately, I think, you know, even if it does come in low, sellers are more apt to work, you know, with that buyer and with that appraisal rather than demolish the entire foundation that they've built with this buyer and with this contract and put it back on the market and have to, you know, start from the ground up again, square one, and do everything again. And so, all in all, again, like I mentioned, just really just trying to get on the same page as with each other, and just trying to, you know, get that deal closed.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't think that there's like really any need to kind of stress people out about this. I mean, it's a very straightforward process for the most part. I mean, you know, I always tell people, like, especially in this market, like 9 out of 10 appraisals are coming in at value or over value. You know, very rarely are we seeing appraisals come in under value. Oftentimes, usually where we've seen it the most recently has been with refinances, you know, because, you know, there's no purchase price to work off of, those sort of things. And so it's truly just up to the, I guess, the opinion of the appraiser. So, you know, and when it does come in low, you know, most, like Zach said, most sellers are willing to work with it. It's a lot easier of a process because you got to figure, you know, at the point of having an appraisal, you're already likely 2 weeks into contract. If you take that property and say, I'm not going to budge on this, and the seller, you know, the buyer's like, I'm not going to bring any money, you know, you're talking about taking it back to market, waiting for more people to come view the house, waiting for another contract offer. And so it's like, you know, what's the reason for selling the property? If you're somebody who's just like willing to sit and just like wants a certain dollar, you know, dollar price, I guess, you know, you don't care that you're going to sit for 3, 4, 5 months, then cool. But if you're somebody who does not want to sit and make a payment, you're somebody who just went and got another house and has this one and they need to sell it, so they're not making two mortgage payments, you know, are you going to be more inclined to take the $5,000 loss, or are you going to be more inclined to try to go back to market and wait another 45, 60 days, you know, to potentially get your extra $5,000, which at that point, what is that going to cost you, you know, to keep it? It's not logical. And so that's, you know, we have a buddy, you know, that we have in contract right now. And that was one of his big questions in the beginning was what happens if the appraisal comes in on, it's like, you know, we'll cross that bridge when we get there ultimately, but it's not going to be as big of a deal as you think it is. Like, it's going to be very, very negotiable. We're going to be able to work through it. It's going to be all right. So, you know, don't worry about it too much. Lo and behold, appraisal comes in. At value, nothing to worry about at all. You know what I mean? So it's just one of those things. It's not something worth losing any sleep over, in my opinion.
Absolutely. And it ultimately, like you mentioned, it's opportunity cost. We've talked about that a few times previously on different episodes, but, you know, opportunity cost, people aren't going to, you know, take their time for 45 to 60 days to haggle over, you know, $5,000. That's just, it's not the smart approach there. So,
yeah. Yep, absolutely. So moving into the next one, this is one that is kind of interesting. It's what if I want to switch loan programs mid-process? And so this is kind of a loaded question. I guess to start, you know, is it possible? Is it something you can do? Yes, it is, but there are some caveats to that. Now, you know, we've talked about it a lot on this, you know, on this this podcast. You know, when you go and write an offer and you offer a specific type of financing type, the seller, that may be a factor in the seller accepting that contract. Specifically, what we're looking at is conventional versus govvy. If you're flipping from one govvy to the next, it's not really going to matter. You know, mostly the reason they get hung up is the appraisal, and the HUD 4000.1 applies to all govvy loans across the board. So if you flip from FHA to USDA, you're not going to get any breaks on the appraisal. So the biggest one would be if you wrote a conventional offer and then you decided that you wanted to change to an FHA offer, whether that was debt to income ratio issues, whether that's, you know, payment issues that we may run into, you want a lower payment, you know, those sort of things. So I will tell you ultimately, yes, it is possible. It is just very dependent on you, the person, and what we're looking to do, what we're trying to do. Some examples of things that could happen and would be likely reasons to switch. You know, we had a client that this is not mid process, this is beginning process, but we pre-approved this client USDA. He went out looking for homes. They made an offer on a property. They got the contract accepted. And once I got the contract, started going through everything, I realized the home was manufactured. USDA will not allow any financing on a manufactured home that was built prior to 2006. This manufactured home was built in like 1986. So obviously we are well off of that requirement. And so the only other option we were going to have was to go FHA for this client if he wanted this house. So, you know, I called him up and just let him know, hey, you know, here's the situation. USDA is just not going to work. They will not finance this mobile home or this manufactured home because of the year that it was built. We can flip you to FHA. We can restructure this to where you're still getting, you know, the benefit of a down payment assistance. That way you're bringing no money, you know, because the USDA obviously had the draw of the zero down. And so I went over the terms with them. We restructured everything, gave him a look at what it would look like. And he decided, hey, you know, that's good enough for me. We really like the house. We want to go through with that. And so that was one of those situations where kind of in the midst of the process, you know, after pre-approval, after we had already talked about the financing type he wanted, you know, we had to flip it to make it work. And so, there's other situations, you know, if you're somebody who somehow came across a bunch of money, you know, maybe an inheritance or something, and you were like, dude, I want to put all this money down. And maybe you were a lower tier credit score, you know, somewhere in the mid sixes, high sixes. And we just didn't think conventional was going to be a great fit. You wanted minimum down payment, or FHA was going to be, no, conventional is going to be a great fit. You know, we're going to take the FHA with a more minimum down payment. And now all of a sudden you're putting such a large down payment down that conventional makes more sense because you're going to get that MI to drop off, you know, those sort of things. So that would be another reason we might consider flipping you from an FHA to conventional. And then there's also, you know, maybe the negative side of things, you know, if somehow, you know, we miscalculated or the income was wrong or you switched jobs and now you're making less income and we pre-approved you conventional and now with the house that you're buying, you're over budget and conventional won't allow it and we got to flip you to FHA to make it work with the debt to income ratios. You know, there's scenarios like that where we've had to kind of, you know, mix and move things to kind of tailor it to, you know, to make the loan work. And so it is possible. It's not something we come across extremely often, but again, if it's something that we need to do, you know, that is something that we can do. But again, I'm going to flip it to Zach here and kind of let him take over the last part of this. Zach, from a seller perspective, you know, what would be the impact of a lender changing, you know, kind of financing types midway through? Specifically, I guess more so like if they were going from a conventional to an FHA, you know, what would a seller think of that or what would be the kind of impact of that?
Well, kind of going backwards to our first what if, generally speaking, you know, as long as the agent and buyers, everybody's being kind of upfront and open in communication about whatever is going on in the transaction with kind of the specific scenarios that you laid out, if it's better for the buyer to do X because of, you know, Y not working out, then, you know, that is something that's going to be understood most times by a seller, and generally speaking. And so again, if I'm representing a seller and this is a scenario, I'm going to do my due diligence by calling, you know, the buyer's lender and getting the full scoop on the story and being able to take that back to the seller itself. So we're not necessarily playing he said, she said at that point. We're going to get the facts of the story, why the buyer wants to switch loan programs, and, you know, kind of get that information. And so the seller can make an informed decision on whether or not he wants to, you know, take that back to market, or not. But ultimately, again, sellers are more likely to work and kind of work around obstacles if we're being upfront and communicative about the about what's going on all in all. And so that's really just kind of from a seller's perspective, just really want open transparency and open communication. And, you know, most obstacles, most problems, whatever they may be, or can be taken care of for sure.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. I mean, it's for the most part, we don't see it ever usually a big deal. Like you said, I mean, most people are willing, most everybody wants to get the deal across the finish line. So the only times that we may have run into, you know, maybe there being a little bit of pushback or some concern is, you know, like I said, if we're flipping from conventional FHA, the house is maybe in a little bit of a rougher shape. There's some things the seller does not want to take care of. They don't want to fix. They may be a little bit more reluctant to say, yeah, we'll let the financing type change. You know, so that could be, you know, one of the reasons where you may have a little bit of pushback from the seller. But again, you know, like Zach said, you know, picking up the phone, just calling, trying to understand what's going on here, why it has to happen this way. And, you know, just kind of having that transparency amongst all parties of what's going on. And usually if that, if you're open with it, you know, yeah, maybe up front, you may have some unhappy campers, but, you know, ultimately, you know, we all are in the business to get the deal to the closing table and get you guys in the house. So, never usually a huge, huge problem.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
All right, Zach, well, take us to our next what if. What are we talking about on kind of the real estate side of things?
So the next what if is going to be, what if I can't find a home I like in my budget? So this is a tough one for sure. You never really, you know, especially when you get into the home search and maybe you don't have an end date timeline that you're necessarily needing to be in the home, but maybe you go, you know, 2-3 months and you haven't even seen a property yet because you don't like anything that's in that price range that you have set out for yourself. My biggest suggestion in that scenario is going to be look a little bit further outside of your, you know, area that you have decided on. Because like we've talked about in previous episodes, you know, different areas can mean different things for taxes, for insurance, for purchase price, all in all. You know, one street over can mean all the difference between, you know, your budget price-wise and your budget tax-wise and your budget insurance-wise. And so it being in different school districts all in all can change that as well. And so again, I would just say my biggest suggestion in that instance, if you can't find a home that you like in your budget, is to just maybe expand your area that you're looking at a little bit further. And so if that's in the Columbus area, maybe we're not going to be looking Columbus proper, but we're looking at different suburbs around the area as well. Or if we're looking at specific neighborhoods in Columbus, you know, maybe moving a little bit to the east or south can change the numbers just a little bit to make you feel a little bit more comfortable with what you are paying each month and paying overall for the property as a whole. And so that's going to be my biggest suggestion, is just to kind of widen your areas a little bit more and kind of, you know, try to find that specific property that you really, really like itself too.
Yeah. And I think from a lending side of things, you know, when we work on that pre-approval process, this is something, you know, some people would call it maybe a come to Jesus moment. But, you know, we do sometimes have to have that conversation with clients, because you do get, you know, those first time home buyers who are looking in it. They've been on Zillow, they've been on Realtor, they see these houses and they're like, this is my budget, this is where I'm at. And then once we dive into things, you know, maybe they are not able to be qualified for as much as they, you know, previously thought that they were. You know, we do try to, you know, set that precedent of just like, hey, you know, based on the current market, based on the area that you're looking in, I think we need to be a little bit realistic about your expectations, what the timeline for finding something in your budget's going to be. Or, hey, like Zach said, maybe we need to look into other areas. You know, maybe you are going to have to move, you know, 10 miles, 15 miles outside of where your preferred destination is. But if that means that you have more houses available to, at your disposal to offer on, to look at that are in your budget, you know, that could be something as well. So I feel like from a lending side of things, we do have to, you know, kind of have those conversations in the beginning as well, especially if we get somebody who, you know, applies for 250 grand. And when we're all said and done, they can afford, you know, 160 grand. You know, that's drastically going to change things for you in the areas that you're looking in, especially the bigger you get to the bigger metropolitan areas. You know, the less that you can be pre-approved for, the tougher it is going to find a quality house in those larger areas. So just something to be aware of there as well.
And something you touched on too is expectations all in all, you know, just setting those proper expectations for yourself. You know, if you have expectations of going into contract, you know, the first house you see or the second house you see, or very, very quickly right after getting pre-approved, likely those expectations are going to be broken regardless of the budget all in all. And so, you know, just kind of setting those proper expectations once you get that pre-approval letter in hand and kind of have that budget in hand, and, you know, can kind of take a look at the desired areas versus the areas that, you know, are realistic for that budget all in all. And, you know, setting the proper expectations can go a long way as well with that. And so, you know, just not getting very disappointed if you're 2 to 3 months into the home search and you can't find anything. You know, if you have those proper expectations set to begin with, you know, we're going to keep on chugging, keep on working and keep, you know, trying to find properties that you're interested in as well. So expectations, setting proper expectations is a big key there as well.
Yeah. Yep. I couldn't agree more. And I mean, just I'll throw it out there because again, we've talked about it a lot and I've still heard people that come to us and say this, the payments that you are seeing on Zillow and realtor.com are based on 20% down. So please, please, please. I think this leads to a lot of why we get, you know, these like loan applications where the amount that is being requested is so high is because they get on these websites and they see that these payments are $1,300 for, you know, $220,000 house. And it's like, guys, like that's with 20,000 down, like your actual loan amount's like 160 grand, which is, yeah, 1300 might be what you can afford, but when you're putting a minimum down payment down, that payment's going to change based on that. And so, you know, that's just always something to think about. So please don't fall into the trap of looking at Zillow and realtor.com payments and falling in love with these houses and falling in love with these payments, all to come to someone like myself and be very, very disappointed when that payment does not come to fruition. Again, I don't think we could ever say that enough, because even no matter how many times we say it, people are still going to do it. So
the good old realtor.com, Zillow.com yes. trap. How many times have we talked about that one on here?
A lot. I mean, we only have like 28 episodes or 27 episodes, and I'm sure we've touched on it at least 15 of them at this point. So, you know, it's just something you gotta be aware of. So please, I mean, if you're putting 20% down, great. I mean, fall in love with the payment, fall in love with the house, everything you want to do. But if you're like, you know, I guess maybe the other 90% of people that are buying homes and you're not putting 20% down, you know, just proceed with caution.
Couldn't agree more, brother. Couldn't agree more. So finishing up here on our last what if, this one's a good one for sure. What if the seller leaves the house a mess? Have you ever had this happen with a client?
I'm actually pretty sure that this happened to my sister who bought her home. I think it was somewhere around like 2 weeks, maybe. Maybe it was longer possession, but they gave him possession because he ultimately wanted time to get all this crap out, and they wanted to make sure that it was out. And he was like leaving. I think the scenario was he was actually leaving and going out of the country. So like a lot of the stuff that was in the house is obviously not going with him on this trip or this move out of country. And so, yes, when they ended up getting access to the house, there was a bunch of crap left over that obviously they thought was going to be taken care of, did not end up being. And so, you know, I'll let you get into talking about like what actually happens if you're the buyer, but I guess spoiler alert, they ended up having to take care of this stuff themselves and get it out of there. So yeah, I personally don't know like any of like our clients that we worked with, but I know like obviously firsthand, yes, my sister bought a house and that happened to her. So
I would say that that's the really only likely scenario where it can happen, honestly, is when you have like a seller holding possession post closing. Because again, 2 days before closing, you should have a final walkthrough and you should be verifying the condition of the property at that point, and making sure that everything is, you know, still an agreed upon working order. That applies to, you know, appliances, that applies to, you know, cosmetic, everything. And obviously it applies to just trash and things laying around the property as well. The property needs to be in the condition that it was agreed upon in the purchase contract as a whole. And so if that does happen, especially in a scenario where a guy's going out of the country, good luck finding him to chase him down to fix it. But I mean, I'm not sure of your legal recourse at that point. I'm not sure that much can be done. Again, before closing, there are scenarios where you can fix it before closing. Obviously, you as a buyer in that final verification walkthrough can walk away from the deal if the property is not in the order that you should be in or that it should be in. So obviously that's part of the reason why that final walkthrough is a very, very big deal. Some clients skip it sometimes. Some clients think that it's not needed, but ultimately to verify the condition of the property that you agreed upon, it is a big deal ultimately. So,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously very unfortunate, you know, for you, the buyer, if that's something that happens, but you know, as for legal recourse, like Zach said, I don't know. I mean, even if there was, how much money would it cost you? How much time is it going to take to track this person down to somehow get them, whatever it would be, court ordered, you know, to do these or pay reparations or whatever the case may be. It's like, how much time and effort are you going to spend to do that you could just clean it up yourself? So, I mean, obviously if it's like a true dump, like, and like the house is like even like beat up, like,
yeah,
then you're talking about something much different than just like leaving it a mess, like leaving your crap everywhere. Unfortunately, like just like in my sister's situation, like you're just at the point where it's like, okay, this sucks, but we're just gonna have to take care of it ourselves. You know what I'm saying? Bring a dumpster, hire a dumpster, grind it out and get the stuff out of here. And obviously it doesn't make for very much fun, but you know, like Zach said, opportunity cost. Do you really want to spend, you know, and what's going to happen? Like, I guess ultimately the best case scenario is you're still going to have to clean it up yourself, right?
Yeah,
because like you're not going to, you're not going to go have your house and then, you know, take the 15, 30, 45 days it's going to take to track this person down, to go through all the legal, you know, actions that you would have to take to get them to do something. And you're just not going to live in your house that whole time. Like you're just going to say, no, I'm not touching it. You know what I mean? So you're likely going to do the work yourself. So, I mean, at most, like you said, you're probably going to negotiate for them to pay the cost for you. And what's that, couple hundred bucks to rent a thing and some physical labor. But I thought that was a good one just because I know it doesn't happen very often, but you know, because a lot of the times, you know, a lot of our contracts that we see at least are possession at closing. So like you said, mm-hmm. you're seeing that property beforehand. And if you're like, yeah, this ain't flying, like you let them know, like I'm not signing these documents until you do this. So once you've agreed to possession after closing, you know, kind of gets a little hard to force somebody's hand at that point when they have 15 days to exit the home. You have no clue what's going on those 15 days.
And you already signed.
Yeah, you already signed. you already own the home. So
yeah. For sure.
Definitely very tough, but thought that was an interesting one to kind of put in there and, you know, something that could definitely really happen for you, even though it's not likely, but, yeah, just wanted to throw that out there.
Absolutely. That was a good one for sure. That was a good one.
Awesome, guys. Well, I think that's going to all but wrap us for the day. Appreciate you guys tuning in, listening to another episode of Closing the Deal. It's been great. We're encroaching on episode 30. As we already talked about at the beginning of the episode, we are halfway through the year. So that means we're, what, halfway through? Halfway through posting all of our posts. We set a goal this year to do one a week, and we have upheld that so far. And I'm excited to finish out the rest of the year, the rest of the half of the year strong for you guys and keep bringing better content. So hopefully, not sure how quickly we'll do another one of these, but just something to keep in the back pocket for a cool little series. So if you guys listen to this, if there's any what ifs that you've heard, any crazy stories out there that you've heard, like, ooh, what if this happens to me? You know, feel free to drop it in the comments, let us know, and maybe we'll feature it on one of the episodes, you know, kind of going through those.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, super, super excited about where we're at with the content and different things we got cooking up. This new little series is pretty cool and shows some different and crazy scenarios that have happened and can happen and will likely again happen at some point, just a matter of who it will happen. And so, yeah, just super excited about the future and everything we got cooking up. So,
absolutely, guys. And just so you know, I mean, I'm excited for this next one. So make sure you guys tune in next week after you listen to this one. We're going to have a new episode with our craziest business stories, like the craziest things that we've encountered, whether that's, you know, just with crazy clients or crazy houses or just crazy deals altogether, anything that, you know, was bizarre and just went awry. To give you guys maybe some good laughs, just some crazy stories about, you know, our time in the business. So I'm excited about that one.
Yeah, that'll 100% be a good one. We got some good stories stacked up, ready to go for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, all right, y'all. Well, appreciate you guys tuning in. Yeah, it's going to wrap us. So we'll see you guys on the next episode next week.